You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the 4th to the 10th of September 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, news editor Simon Baker and reporter Jack Grove. Coming up, could tougher government rules on visa refusal rates lead to universities losing their license to recruit overseas students? That's our splash this week. How easy or indeed viable is it for busy scholars to combine academic success with responsible parenting? Six fascinating stories in our features section this week. We'll talk a bit more about that later. And graduates apparently think fewer people should go to university than the rest of the population. But why is that? We'll ask Jack in a second. And finally, I'll let you know who's been nominated or made the shortlist, I should say, for the 2014 THE University of the Year. That's to be announced at the THE Awards a little bit later this year. Simon, splash this week's by John Morgan. He's not here, but as news editor, you can stand in. It's all about the possible implications of a change in the visa application failure rates that universities are allowed.
This announcement's kind of not new in some ways because it came just before the kind of parliamentary recess at the end of July. But basically, the government announced some more strict rules on student visas and when universities would face losing their kind of right to sponsor students. They cut a kind of threshold by which universities are allowed a certain percentage of students they offer a place to then fail to get a visa, and that was 20%.
So this is the confirmation of acceptance for studies letters that universities...
Yeah, they send out a certain number of these kind of confirmation that, you know, we're going to offer you a place, and that they use this to apply for a visa. And if they then fail to get a visa, it used to be 20% of those students fail to get a visa, then in the future the government might remove their right to sponsor students, because basically on the basis that the government would believe that you're then offering these letters to students that really shouldn't be offered a visa. But that's been lowered to 10% now from November, and there's a fear that kind of, you know, a lot of these failures happen when, you know, there's a kind of just error in documentation, when the government or Home Office interviews these students, which it does tend to is doing more and more now, that they ask them quite a detailed question about what's in the module they're going to study, and they get that wrong. So there's a kind of worry that they might fail to get a visa for quite arbitrary reasons.
Well, financial. I mean, we had that story, didn't we, some time ago about an Indian student who was denied a visa just because he was 20 quid short of the amount of money that you need to have in your bank account to cover your kind of, as a slush fund, to cover your expenses while you're here. And
that was just the exchange rate, wasn't it?
That was the exchange, that's right, yeah. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that's completely outside of university's control. And it doesn't mean that that student wasn't a credible, you know, bright young student that would have been an asset to that university in this country, but...
There's certainly a suspicion that if the government is, as it is, trying to reduce immigration generally as a target for it, then, you know, will there be some decisions that kind of are on the side of rejecting a visa when maybe they wouldn't in other, you know, in another political situation, you know, there would obviously no suggestion that that happens, but there will be suspicions along those lines. So anyway, but the bottom line is that there's a fear that this lowering of the threshold is going to affect quite a lot of universities, because the average failure rate for the sector seems to be around 9%. It leaves a lot of universities above the 10%. A figure of 40 institutions has been bandied around by sources. And, you know, I'm not saying that 40 universities would lose their right to sponsor students, but they're the ones that are going to have to take measures to monitor what they do more closely and to make sure they don't fall above this 10%.
It's clear that we've got this figure of about 9% average across the sector refusal rate, and then we've got a quote from the Russell Group saying that their average is 2%. So, you know, there clearly are going to be a bunch of institutions
that are a lot higher.
That are a lot higher than that 9%. Tripping them over the 10% threshold.
Although the piece does say that some Russell Group institutions could be affected by this, of course.
Yeah, but you only need two that are kind of above the 10%, and then everyone else below 5% to create, you know. Or sort of somewhere with a very low rate to create an average of two. The big worry is for small institutions, actually, because, you know, if you're a small institution and you only take on
like a handful or a couple of dozen of, well, I'd say 20 for argument's sake, international students, well, then you're talking your percentage threshold is quite high, isn't it? You only have two have to fail to get a visa out of the ones you offer, and that's your 10%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The implications are huge, aren't they? I mean, London Met temporarily lost its recruitment licence in 2012. I was reading the report this week from the Observatory of Borderless Higher Education, said that cost them around about $34 million. I mean, it's big money, isn't it? And it's not just in student fees, it's the reputation of the institution, isn't it, that suffers if this happens.
Yeah, your name gets dragged through the news, you know, and that's happened obviously to a few institutions, but just the other side of the summer, didn't it, when you know, Glyndor's licence was suspended and a couple of other universities prevented recruiting new students. So, you know, it's not just about the kind of actual pure financial gain that you get from having these students study with you.
Absolutely. Well, page 6 and 7 for that story this week. Now, our cover feature this week sees six scholars talking about their approach to combining academic work with parenting. John, perhaps we'll come to you on this, as your leader is all about this issue. They're interesting stories. This is a work-life balance story, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those issues, isn't it, that you always hear discussed. I mean, it's clearly more of a problem for the careers of female academics. You can, you know, the famous or infamous leaky pipeline that sees you know, many you know, very talented female academics falling by the wayside as they go from postdoc, you know, up through the career ladder. Is inescapably because of this overlap between, you know, the years that you're building an academic career and the years that if you have a family, you're likely to be having a family. And it's incredibly tough for people to manage both those things. And probably, actually, you know, there is a deficit of, you know, there isn't enough support from universities and from higher education in general to make that career building and family building something that can be done simultaneously. But
is that something that comes out in these stories?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a really interesting range of stories here from people who, you know, are parents of children who are now adult, who talk about their sort of, you know, how they dealt with it. Some of them, you know, including Susan Bassnett, for example, who you know, dealt with it as a single mum for a long period of time, and you can just see it's incredibly hard work. You've got other people there who say that they've managed it, but they don't think they would manage it today because, you know, the pressure on young academics to publish earlier in their careers and make a name for themselves in academic circles is much higher than it was once. And we've also got people who have very young children or are thinking about parenthood, either definitely planning it or thinking that maybe they won't go into, you know, won't have children, talking about the issues that they're facing. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, one young female early career researcher talks about, yes, all the practical difficulties that we sort of pick over at length, but also saying that there are some sort of internal blocks that academics put up themselves. She says, for example, that there's an element of sort of perfectionism in many academics, that they want to be the absolute best they can be at whatever it is they do, and that would include parenting. So, yes, they would be brilliant parents, but actually perhaps they find the idea of just sort of muddling through and being the best they can be a very unattractive prospect, as she puts it. So there's all sorts of different issues at play here, and I think it's really interesting to read the different approaches and different experiences that people have had.
The person who gets up at four in the morning to start work before taking your children to school.
Philip Moriarty at the University of Nottingham.
Seems a pretty
I think one of the
gig.
Some of the things that come through are that you get very early mornings, very late nights, weekend work. Many academics will say, well, they do all those things anyway, perhaps, but it's really tough. I think there's some good fun in these pieces as well. We've got Andrew Oswald, who's a professor at Warwick, talking about sort of the moment that he realised. He said he only really realised this when one of his now adult daughters gave a speech at a birthday party, and he realised that he'd essentially brought his children up just as his dad brought him up, kind of dragging them to, you know, he says that when he was growing up, his dad, who was a professor, used to take them to the lab at weekends and leave them locked in his car, knocking about by themselves for a few hours while he went and did his work. And he said, he jokingly, but I think there's a semi-serious point to this, says that, you know, you have to sort of have some faith in the robustness of children and understand that, he says, even if you largely ignore your children, they will probably survive. Which is, you know, not good parenting advice, but it's nice to know.
I suppose that depends if there's someone else in the background is paying attention to them.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? And the bottom line is, yes, you know, you can leave someone locked in the car for a couple of hours, but you can't do that as a long-term proposition. They still need feeding and putting to bed and so on.
Absolutely. Well, page 40 for that feature this week. The second feature this week sees Nicholas Till, who's Professor of Opera and Music Theatre and Leverhulme Research Fellow at the University of Sussex, explaining why he owes so much to a period on the dole during Thatcher's time in power, and why a degree from Cambridge is actually among his regrets. So do check that out too. Jack, moving on to one of your articles this week. It's an analysis of the British Social Attitudes Survey. The analysis has been done by academics at King's, the Institute of Education, the University of Manchester. They find that privileged graduates want fewer people to follow in their scholarly footsteps. That's the headline, at least, of your piece.
Yeah, this is a paper that's going to be presented at a conference this month in London. And it's looking at how the attitudes of different parts of the population to higher education, and graduates are twice as likely as non-graduates to say that access to university should be restricted, which seems slightly strange because given that they've been to university, benefited from it, they are sort of almost not recommending it for other people. And there's Stephen Jones from Manchester, who's a co-author on this report, says it's a bit of a case of pulling the ladder up behind you, which is quite an interesting idea. I mean, it's basically saying that the mainstream public discourse about higher education is very much about dumbing down, and too many people are going to university, and entry requirements are going down, and people should do things like apprenticeships instead. But actually, while that's coming out of newspapers and being, which tend to be written by predominantly middle-class people nowadays, a bit like myself. But actually, if you actually ask people, the general public, they're actually pretty supportive of increasing student places and offering more opportunities to people, which is actually the policy of the government. So there's a sort of interesting disconnect going on with all the stories saying too many people are going to university.
It's that weird sort of, you know, it's the same, isn't it? They're all right-wing thinking about reducing access to higher education, that, you know, some fewer young people should go to university, but it should be someone else's children and not mine that don't.
Exactly. And all this talk about sort of Mickey Mouse degrees and that, you know, these sort of modern universities shouldn't be universities. We hear that through various comments occasionally on our message boards, but actually the general public seems to disagree with this. 50% is quite a reasonable figure. 50% of people going to university is quite a reasonable figure, according to most people. Quite a lot of people want more people to go, so it's an interesting study.
I really like this thing that you picked out here about, they noticed that the phrasing of the question had changed over the decades, you know, so maybe 20 years ago they were kind of asking how important it was for working class people to go to university, or how important it was for people to go to university generally, and now you've got questions in the Social Attitudes Survey saying university education just isn't worth the amount of time and money it usually takes. Agree or disagree. It's like kind of, it does show like a survey can lead you towards a different, you know, how you phrase the question. You know.
The way the question is phrased has changed. I don't know exactly why, but maybe that's reflecting some of the attitudes that are coming in recently. Mm. But Dr. Jones says actually people are, no matter how you phrase the question, people still pretty supportive of higher education.
Good, good. Yes, that's in our news section this week, along with plenty of other stories. Do take a look. Now, the THE Awards 2014 will take place on the 27th of November in London. This week in the magazine, you'll see all the nominations for all the categories. You should have a look. The shortlist, I should say, is published in full. I did say I'd let you know the University of the Year nominees. They are Birkbeck, Edge Hill, the University of Glasgow, Harper Adams, Institute of Education, University of London, and Swansea University. So well done to all them, but check out the magazine for the full rundown and indeed the website. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed or indeed anything in the magazine, you can find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Facebook, on Twitter, Google+, LinkedIn, all the usual places, so do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.